Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, and the time now is just, 30 seconds before the top of the hour. That's 11 o'clock. Coming up next on KBOO, we have Jenna Yokoyama, who talks with activists fighting to bring attention to the continuing radiation crisis at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan, near where the Tokyo Olympics are scheduled. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate. And now, stay tuned for more about the Fukushima nuclear plant.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 11th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The Big Sick. This screening benefits the Bus Project. Again, that's The Big Sick, showing Monday, March 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
Today marks the 8th anniversary of the disaster in Fukushima. I'm joined in studio with Laura Feldman, and we are going to be talking today about the state of Fukushima today and what's happening with the Japanese government. And we're also going to get into the Olympics that are going to be happening in Japan. But first, we're going to hear a speech that was presented by activist Riko Muto back in September of 2011. On March 11, 2011, the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan suffered a nuclear accident after sustaining damage in the Tohoku earthquake and subsequent tsunami. Over the following years, the people of Fukushima and its surrounding areas are still seeking truth and accountability from their government, while controversy and division among the people of Fukushima further complicates finding lasting resolutions. Here we bring you a speech by Japanese nuclear activist Riko Muto, speaking at the Goodbye Nuclear Plants rally in September of 2011, where she speaks out against the government's handling of the disaster.
Hello, everyone. I came here today from Fukushima. I came along with many busloads of my companions, both from Fukushima Prefecture itself and from the places to which we have evacuated. For many, this is the first time to participate in a rally or demonstration. We reached out, invited each other along, and came here today because we want to tell you about the grief caused by the accident at the nuclear plant in Fukushima, and because we are determined that we, of all people, will raise our voices to say that we do not want nuclear reactors. There are a few things I would like to say at the start. I want to express my deep respect for each one of you who have tackled so many things each day in the midst of this difficult period since 3/11 in order to protect life. I also want to express my gratitude to all of you who have warmly reached out to connect with the people of Fukushima Prefecture and to support us in various ways. Thank you. And to all the children and young people whom this accident has forced to shoulder a heavy burden, I want to apologize from my heart on behalf of the generation that brought about such a situation. I am truly sorry. I want to tell you all that Fukushima is a very beautiful place. To the east, the Hamadori region gazes out across the deep blue Pacific Ocean. The Nakadori region is a treasure house of fruits, peaches, pears, and apples. Golden rice stalks droop their heads on the Aizu Plain around Lake Inawashiru and Mount Bandai, while the far side is framed by deep mountain ranges. This land, with its blue mountains and clear water, is our homeland. The nuclear accident of 3/11 was the turning point. Radiation, invisible to the eye, descended on this landscape, and we too became Hibakushua, atomic bomb and radiation victims. In the midst of widespread confusion, various things happened to us. Caught between a rapidly rolled out safety campaign and feeling of alarm, the connections between people were torn apart. Who can say how many people worried and grieved in our localities, our workplaces, our schools, our homes? Day after day, many inescapable decisions were forced upon us, to flee or not to flee, to eat or not to eat, to make our children wear masks or not to make them, to hang the laundry outside or not to hang it outside, to plow our fields or not to plow them, to speak out about something or to remain silent. There were various agonizing decisions. And now here we are. During the past half year, the following things have become clear. The truth of the situation is being hidden. The state is not protecting its citizens. The accident is still not over. The inhabitants of Fukushima Prefecture are being made the subjects of a nuclear experiment. A huge volume of radioactive waste remains. Despite the enormous price we have already paid, there are powers intent on driving nuclear power production forward. We have been discarded. We have deep sighs of exhaustion and overwhelming sadness. But the words that spill from our mouths are, "Don't you dare treat us like fools. Don't snatch away our lives." In the midst of our anger and grief, we, the citizens of Fukushima, are quietly rising up. Mothers and fathers, grandmothers and grandfathers protecting their children, the younger generation fighting to stop their future from being stolen, workers trying to help those cleaning up the stricken nuclear plant exposed to huge doses of radiation in the process, farmers filled with despair at the contamination of their land, people with disabilities determined that the radiation should not give rise to a new discrimination and separation. One by one, each of us citizens is asking questions about the responsibility of the state and of TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Corporation. And we are raising our voices to say, no more nuclear reactors. We have become the ogres of Tohoku, quietly burning with fury. We, the people of Fukushima, want to share our suffering, responsibility, and hope, and to support each other as we move forward with our lives, whether we have left our hometowns or have stayed on our land. Please join with us. Please take note of the actions that we are undertaking. Negotiations with the government, evacuation rulings, temporary evacuation, recovering our health, decontamination, measurement of radiation levels, and learning about nuclear reactors and radioactivity. And we are going everywhere to tell people about Fukushima. Today, companions of ours are giving speeches in New York. We are working on this in every way we can think of. Please help us. Please don't forget Fukushima. There is one more thing that I want to talk about, which is how we each live our lives. We need to imagine the world on the far side of that socket into which we plug things so heedlessly. We need to put our minds on the fact that convenience and development come at the price of discrimination and sacrificing people. Nuclear power plants are on the far side of that socket. The human race is no more than one species among the living creatures on this earth. Is there any other species that usurps its own future? I want to live as a living being should, in harmony with this beautiful planet. Although it may be a small thing, I want to treat energy as a precious resource and weave an ingenious, rich, creative life. How can we build a new world that is the polar opposite of one reliant on nuclear reactors? Nobody knows the full answer to that. But I think each one of us can do, in complete and total honesty, is to think with our own minds. Make sure to open our eyes wide. Decide what we can do and act on it, rather than following what someone else has decided. Let us remember that each one of us has that power. Every one of us has the courage to change. Let us reclaim the confidence that was taken from us, and then let us connect with each other. If the power that even now aims to advance nuclear plants is a vertical wall looming over us, our power extends horizontally, without limits, through our ongoing connection. Try reaching out and gently holding the hand of the person next to you. Let's look at each other and listen to each other's pain. Let's allow each other's anger and tears. Let's spread the warmth of these hands we're holding now throughout Japan and the world. However overwhelmingly heavy the burden each one of us has to bear, however rough the road that we have to travel, let us support each other so that we do not lose sight of our goal, and let us live through this time freely and brilliantly.
That was a speech by Japanese anti-nuclear activist Riko Muto, speaking at a nuclear rally in Japan in September of 2011, 6 months after the nuclear accident at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. The translation was by Emma Parker and was voiced by Laura Feldman. That audio was originally aired here on Cable Community Radio in the evening news last year, and we've arrived at year eight, and we don't see too much movement, actually, in when it comes to cleaning this up or when it comes to actually addressing it by the Japanese government. And here in studio with me is Laura Feldman. Laura, you are actually the voice of the translation there on that recording, and you're actually one of the people who brought that audio to me.
Right.
What inspired you to take on this issue?
Well, Jenna, I'm a Hanford activist, the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, and I was at a wonderful event up at Whitman College called the Hanford Nagasaki Bridge Project Symposium. And I was there with my friend Yukio Kawano, an artist who couldn't be with us today, but she and I talked about how we just couldn't bear another Fukushima anniversary going by without anybody taking notice here in Portland. And so what can we do? What can we do? And Yuki brought this speech to me and the translation, and I read it. And then we came to you, Jenna, where you did the expert work of blending the two versions. And then it was aired on KABU, and that was just such a huge relief and wonderful moment. I don't think anything else was happening in Portland last year, and I don't think anything this year is happening in Portland, but we're doing something. And at that Hanford Nagasaki Bridge Project Symposium, we met Norma Field, who was one of the presenters, and she's for this special anniversary, we're going to be talking with Norma, which is just even more wonderful. And Norma is a close friend of Riko's, and she's a scholar who has been working on Fukushima issues since 2011. She's a professor emerita of the University of Chicago and a contributing editor to the Asian Pacific Journal and a board member of CORE, Consequences of Radiation Exposure. That was the group that put on the Hanford Nagasaki Bridge Project last year, which was just so amazing. And so I want to welcome Norma. She's calling in from Chicago, and interview her, and let's see what's been going on in Fukushima since last year.
Welcome, Norma.
Hi, Jenna and Laura. I'm so grateful to be given a chance to share this time and space with you.
Oh, we're grateful.
So, you know, for a lot of people here in the United States, as we said, there aren't any sort of anniversaries or aren't any sort of actions taking place on March 11th. And I think it's one success by the government to be able to cover these things up, but two, we just are very ignorant here in the United States about what maybe even happened back at the Fukushima plant. Besides, we heard, okay, we all globally knew that there was a disaster, but the fallout from that, the conversation pretty much went silent very shortly afterwards. So to kind of recap our brains from 8 years ago, Norma, do you want to kind of give us a short summation of what has happened in those years since March 11th of 2011?
Sure. It's no accident that it's forgotten here, and because there's a huge effort, unfortunately pretty successful, on the part of the Japanese government to get Japanese to forget, too, that this happened. And in fact, I know Ruiko and all her comrades and everyone else struggling with this issue will be so grateful to learn that this is being talked about on a Portland community radio station, precisely because of this effort to make us all forget. People who suffered and continue to suffer from the disaster always say, it's as if this disaster had never happened. And so we can summarize their struggles as saying, we're not going to let them get away with saying, making it seem that this never happened. Now, remember that there was a huge earthquake, an enormous calamitous earthquake followed by a tsunami that took out the generators, the diesel generators that are on site in case electricity is lost. We know that nuclear reactors cannot function without constant amounts, huge volumes of cooling water. And once that water was knocked out, the reactors started heating up and we ended up having hydrogen explosions. Also, the reactors had to be vented, which meant that a lot of radionuclides deliberately were released into the atmosphere and the surrounding environment in order to prevent worse disasters from happening, as well as what inevitably happened with the tops being blown off. And for your readers who might, your listeners who might have some idea about Chernobyl, which is 1986, Chernobyl was covered by what's been called a sarcophagus. And it had to be renewed because the degree of radioactivity within was such that the first sarcophagus was no longer adequate to contain the materials, radionuclides, radioactivity inside. And the European Union spent a huge sum of money to recover it recently. The Fukushima reactors have not been covered. And so in many ways, we're still much more vulnerable to what's coming out of there, both in terms of the atmosphere and the water and soil. You may have seen those maps or remember those maps showing concentric circles as the Japanese government went from about 3 miles to finally about 12, and at one point almost 20, but drew back from the 20, of evacuation zones. I think any of us can imagine that radioactivity is not going to cooperate with concentric circles arbitrarily drawn by a government. And why are those circles drawn? It's in anticipation of what the consequences will be to have X percentage of the population exposed. To have to evacuate is a huge financial burden. It's also very hard for the people who have to leave, but it's a huge financial burden down the road. And the government was clearly determined to minimize what its responsibilities would be going down the road. And it, remember, the Japanese government has historical practice with this in terms of how compensation would eventually be paid to the victims of the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs. And so, in a sense, drawing on that experience of how to take some responsibility and yet not make that responsibility overwhelming, by which I mean adequate to the needs, the government severely restricted the boundaries of the people who were going to be let out, supported to let out. Duiko, in this beautiful, beautiful speech, which actually moves me to tears every time I hear it, tells us that this beautiful prefecture is divided. It's a very large area, by the way, corresponding to the size of the state of Connecticut. It's the third largest prefecture in Japan. And you can divide it from the sea into three regions, and the coastal region is where the reactors were. And the middle region is where the great cities are, the prefectural capital, Fukushima City, and the commercial capital, Koriyama. This is where the major expressways go and the bullet train. And I'm always remembering reading something not long after the disaster struck of a middle school teacher saying that a student living, this was a school in this middle region, saying, "Teacher, I get it. I get it why we're not being allowed to evacuate. It's because they'd have to stop the bullet train." And I think that's pretty much on the mark, that there was effort to safeguard, not to disrupt the economic activities. And secondly, in terms of constricting evacuation, not to let the tax base out of the prefecture. And so now there's tremendous effort to bring it back in. Let me say a word about that, the site itself.
I was wondering, Nora, if you could let us know, mm-hmm. what is the state of it now? Mm-hmm. Is it habitable at all? Are people living there? What does it look like if you were to visit the prefecture today?
Yes. That's a good question, because by site, how narrowly or broadly are we going to define it? And one of the first things I have to say is, just as the concentric circles don't work, the prefectural boundaries don't work either. The radioactivity, certainly the initial plume went far beyond, went further south and west even of Tokyo. So we call it the Fukushima nuclear disaster, but it really does cover pretty much the northeastern part of Japan down to Tokyo and elsewhere. And we have to remember those powerful currents that have transported the radionuclides around the globe, including to the Pacific coast.
Yes, and even here on the West Coast, pieces of the tsunami washed up along the coast here in California, and Seattle and Portland. So that was, I guess, our little note to remind us that we're all very connected.
Yeah, we are connected. So if I start in the narrowest way with the site itself, there are various intense efforts being made. Right now I read there are about 4,000 workers a day on site. Many of them are subcontract labor, which is a huge issue, of course, because they're not making a whole lot of money. They are being exposed, and it is grueling work. TEPCO now says 96% of the site can be that workers can be there with very minimal protection, but one wouldn't want to take them at their word for that. Because these reactors remain so radioactive, I think some listeners may have seen recently of successes with a robot finally touching the melted fuel, pebble-like fuel in one of the reactors. That was a huge step. Now, this is 8 years in, because basically where all the melted fuel went is still in question. Something I learned rather recently is that the reason Japan, this technologically advanced nation, hasn't been able to develop the robots to do the job to identify where the fuel, the melted fuel is, and in general to figure out what happened, is that robots are vulnerable, like us, to radioactivity, and so that their programs get rewritten when they're exposed, and that's why most of them have failed to return. So we can't count on robots to give us the information. I'm not even talking about getting the place stabilized or under control, just to give us basic information about where bits and pieces of the fuel might be. And in general, what that might tell us about what happened, because the places where radioactivity levels are highest are not necessarily nearest the core, which one of the suggestions is a lot of it got out into the atmosphere, and we know that because we're finding things, new things called microparticles. So there is the site. We should also remember that the water, the loss of coolant that led to this disaster in the first place, these cores are going to have to be cooled forever. And at the moment, because their precise site is not known, workers are kind of aiming in where they think the core might be of the three reactors. The fourth reactor was not in operation at the time, so we worried about the spent, very, very hot spent fuels. But the three reactors just aiming one. And we might as well say that in perpetuity, even if, for instance, someday the bad, sensible thing were done, which is to cover the place, the site has to keep being cooled. So there is that issue. And the fact that so much water is required to keep things from reaching criticality again means that there is a huge amount of contaminated water. And that is one of the most visible signs associated with this nuclear disaster, is that the sea of tanks piling up on the Fukushima Daiichi site, holding the contaminated water. The Japanese government, or rather TEPCO, had said that everything except for tritium, pretty much, had been removed, had been filtered out. Tritium is so close to water, heavy water, so that there seems to be no technology we have now that can separate the tritium out. And therefore, authorities have tried to say that tritium is really harmless, which seems not to be the case at all. But in any case, last August, TEPCO had to say, as it was preparing to get the public to accept the fact that these tanks really have to be dumped into the Pacific, that actually most of the other radionuclides hadn't been removed either. Now, here's another kind of thing that's astonishing to be finding out, 7.5 years later, and when we've been told that the filtration had been successful, that all this water still remains pretty highly radioactive. When I say that TEPCO is preparing to get the public to accept having these tanks emptied into the Pacific, that's not to say that it hasn't been leaking accidentally and deliberately along the way. So it's not as if this is a new event, but it would be on a very new scale. Mm-hmm. To convey the scale, I can just say that apparently a thousand ton tank of radioactively contaminated water is filled every 7 to 10 days. And TEPCO is saying, we're just running out of space. We've got to do something about this. And besides, in getting the reactors under control, we have to find space to put the spent fuel.
Norma,
so we need space for that.
Ask you a quick question about RICO's. She initiated a lawsuit against TEPCO executives and government officials. Can you update us on that?
And can you also give us a little background about TEPCO? I'm in the role of all this for people who aren't too familiar with the giant.
Yes. So until recently, until after Fukushima, actually, when there was something called electricity or power liberalization, the Japanese nation was divided into these regions where one power company had a monopoly. And TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, is the giant for the metropolitan area. It has one important thing is that TEPCO's plant that resulted in this, that produced this disaster, is in Fukushima Prefecture. So it's not in Tokyo. It's not even in the geographic region. So why is that? So TEPCO in Fukushima was sited there just to produce electricity for the people of Tokyo. So one could say got some advantages, taxes, public facilities, but they were not benefiting from the power generated by TEPCO. Now, moving on to the court case, the thing that's really important to know is that We're calling it Noriko's court case, and indeed without her, I'm skeptical that it would have happened. But this is a criminal case. In other words, this is a case where the government of Japan is pursuing the indictment of three top TEPCO executives. This is different. There are about 30 other civil cases of evacuees and other people who are claiming damages, who are the plaintiffs with TEPCO as the defendants. But in this case, it's the government, it's the state. And why is this important? First of all, it's a miracle that it happened, mm-hmm. because prosecutors who are the people who are supposed to investigate when a likely crime has taken place, investigated and decided that no one could be held responsible for this disaster. And it's Noriko and all her citizens, in the end about 1,300 plus citizens who joined what's called a complaint and said, we demand that an indictment be made against TEPCO. There were other people at first. And there was a miraculous, little known legal mechanism in Japan, something like the grand jury in the United States, but without prosecutors involved. It's a citizen, arbitrarily elected citizens who finally decided that, yes, there are three people who should be indicted. And it's the tenacity of these citizens who insisted that you can't have something on this scale happen and nobody be held responsible, have no investigation. So that's one of the reasons this court case is so important, it's saying we can't be silent, having had our lives turned upside down, having really our land contaminated forever, and be told that no one was responsible for it. That's one thing that's important. The other thing that's important about this, there are three things, well, two and a half. One is the insistence in exploring responsibility officially. The second is, they're all related, is that when you have a trial, then all kinds of evidence come out. You can subpoena, right? And so finally, these are most of the documents that are being unearthed and disclosed in this trial are documents that the official prosecutors had known about but had refused to construe as grounds for a case. So we have evidence coming out. And thirdly, this really goes back to, I think, what you could catch in Noriko's speech. The way she and her partners, her collaborators, her fellow victim survivors went about persuading people to bring a complaint. You may often have heard that Japanese people are averse to suing in the courtroom, but was to go around and actually talk to people one on one and say, what did this do to you? What about your life was changed by this? And so this is, as she says in the end of her speech, we really have to think about what kind of life, what kind of society we want. The very nature of this court case started out from an examination of citizens' lives and how they were upended forever through this court case. So in all those ways, this case is very important. A final session at the district court level will take place March 12th. I wonder how they came up with that date, the day after the anniversary. Because, as I mentioned, the official prosecutors refused to prosecute through this special mechanism of the grand jury, something like the grand jury, five attorneys were appointed by the court to serve as prosecutors. And in their closing arguments, they demanded five-year prison terms, which is the maximum for corporate negligence leading to injury and death. And so on March 12th, we'll be hearing from the defendant's attorneys.
If you're just tuning, sorry to interrupt you there. I just want to make sure everyone knows who we're speaking to. We're listening to Norma Field right now, and you are tuned into Cable Community Radio. Today being March 11th, we are talking about the incident at Fukushima, which also known as 311 if you're in Japan. And here in the United States, there's actually very little known about it. So we are talking about what is currently happening in Fukushima 8 years after the disaster there. And Norma Field, expert, right now is speaking about the court case that has been brought forth in Japan, where there is an attempt to hold somebody responsible for this. But as we know, the Japanese government, or maybe you don't know if you're not too familiar with the Japanese government, is often very successful at keeping things under wraps. And activists such as Riko Muto and people like Norma Field and people like Laura Feldman, who are here in studio with me today, are taking great efforts to make sure that the public at large is aware of what is going on. So, Norma, as you were just talking about... I'm sorry to have interrupted you there.
Not at all.
To continue about, so tomorrow you're saying that the courts, what's going to be happening tomorrow on March 12th?
So it will be the last session of the first round of the criminal trial. And I really do want to emphasize that it's a criminal trial, that these executives are being charged with a crime. And just as one, I think many people might remember that the whole point was this was cast as a natural disaster, right? There was an earthquake, there was a tsunami. This kind of tsunami couldn't have been anticipated. Therefore, no one's responsible. And what has come out through this court case is that in 2007, so the key years are 2007-2008, when a government earthquake expert body had said that we can anticipate a tsunami of this level arising on that coast within the next X number of years. And in fact, within TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, employees, experts on the earthquake and construction people started to raise the seawall to try to meet what was anticipated in this government report. And this has been attested to, and we know that this report was raised. Now, the defendants have all claimed that they never heard about it, or they know about earthquakes or don't know about tsunamis, or they don't remember hearing it. Maybe the employees are under the misapprehension that they told their bosses but forgot. But it's been attested to in court that they were specifically told to cancel their plans to provide for protection. So that's something to keep in mind. You asked earlier about the site, and I wanted to say more about if we move out from the site itself, and let's just remember, it's not really secure. It's not under control. Japan still has earthquakes. It gets typhoons. And the very process of trying to stabilize this place can create more discharges and releases. But the really important thing to understand is that in contrast to the Chernobyl disaster, once things got going with addressing what Chernobyl meant for people living there, in contrast, the Japanese government has tried very hard to keep people in the place and somehow contain the radioactivity, instead of prioritizing removing people to safety, including women and pregnant children. And so what we've had is what's called decontamination. It could mean power hosing roofs. A lot of that was done. It can mean collecting yard waste. It can mean turning over, scraping off topsoil and or turning it over. All of which produces more radioactive waste. And so along with all the tanks with the radioactively contaminated water, there are just mountains and mountains of actually quite tidy bags, flexible container bags, or huge, huge garbage bags filled with the fruit, shall we say, of decontamination. And as you can imagine, it's very hard to contain radioactivity, especially you have organic material in these bags, so people have had to put little chimneys in the bags to vent the gases that are formed, so much for sealing everything in. It's also, in order to reduce the volume, portable mobile incinerators have been developed at huge expense to incinerate many of these bags, which, true to be, does reduce the volume.
But they're literally, you're saying they're literally taking these bags and they're just burning the bag and the contents in them, and they're just allowing all these emissions to just kind of float into the air?
No, they have something called bag filters. But bag filters, you won't be surprised to learn, do not catch everything. And you've also concentrated. By incinerating, you're also concentrating. So bags containing a certain level of contamination have been incinerated. Others are stacked up. The government promised that Fukushima would not be the final resting place of the radioactive waste, but surprise, surprise, it's having a hard time finding communities willing to be paid off to accept this waste. And so most of it has remained in Fukushima, except that there is also waste in other prefectures, as I mentioned. And so there's incineration, there's burial in the yards where the waste came from. And now, preparing for the Olympics, for better optics, bags are being dug up. I heard someone saying that people came to her house and dug up the bags they had buried in her yard a few years ago, and then with their hands took out the contents and relayed them into other bags. This is in Fukushima City, the capital city, where there's a large public recreation facility where several Olympic softball games and one baseball game are scheduled to be played. And this facility also has, shall we say, sited or hosted a number of these flexible container bags. This is, as I said, where some of the Olympic games are to take place. So these bags are being moved around. In some cases, they're being carted off, I mean, again, out of sight to an elevated level. And then I should have prefaced all this by saying that Fukushima Prefecture is 70% forested or mountainous. That's what makes it so beautiful. You cannot decontaminate forests and mountains. And so whatever is done through decontamination was already very, very limited to begin with. Third solution, recycling, except the use language is reuse. The government, the Environment Ministry, having decided that there are way too many bags to dispose of, you know, many, many stadia worth of bags, and that therefore 8,000 becquerels per kilo, that's a pretty high contamination level. Bags, soil and yard waste, 8,000 becquerels or under, should be able to be reused in public works projects. And so now they are going around Fukushima Prefecture, going to townships, and trying to persuade the residents that it would be a good idea to accept this soil, particularly, to use it to widen highways. It'll be covered over with something else, so not to worry. In some cases, even to use them to create new, agricultural spaces.
Oh, my God.
Again, they're going to be covered over again.
Yes. So if you're in Japan, what is the reaction of the public? Is there anyone pushing back at large, sort of saying, no, we don't want this, quote unquote, like recycled, reused, you know, contaminated materials to be used? Or are people pretty accepting? Or is the government so controlling of the message that people don't realize the harm? What is it like to be your average person in the region in Japan?
Apparently, this campaign, the reuse campaign, by which the Environment Ministry figures that it can reuse about 80% of this enormous volume of contaminated soil waste, is not going well. That's a relief, isn't it? That The municipalities are, the people are standing up, and mayors are being pressured to push back to the prefectural government to say, this is not the this is not what you told us. You told us this waste was not going to stay here, and now you're saying you're going to reuse it in public parks, public works projects. So you're bringing it right back into our living space. So yes, there is a lot of pushback, but not everywhere.
And on a national level, the narrative of the Olympics, hosting the Olympics, is that it's all under control. We're taking care of everything. So we have no way of knowing what the average person suffers there.
Right, because most people in other parts of Japan, unless they have are evacuees or have gotten involved with evacuee groups, are not hearing about this. And even though I think many people around the world, many cities have begun to understand that the Olympics are not necessarily a wonderful thing on many, many grounds, I think a lot of people are easily fall prey to the notion that, well, this has got to be good for business. You know, in fact, the Japanese government has been very successful with its messaging. So tourism has really recovered in Japan. The messaging of the Olympics as a chance to showcase the reconstruction and recovery of Japan from the triple disaster seems to be very plausible, to say the very least, and within Japan itself.
Gosh.
Can we talk a little bit, because we're kind of coming up on our last few minutes here, and I want to highlight the work that you, Norma, are doing in Chicago. Can you talk about your work as Chicago Japanese Embassy?
we only have a consulate, but the Midwest region. This is tied up with the Olympics, mostly. There's a group, the Nuclear Energy Information Service, which is almost 35 years old in Chicago, that a group that I have come to know since the Fukushima disaster. And people associated with that group and others have done every year on March 11th or on the weekday closest to it, in front of the Consulate General of Japan in Chicago. And this is with a banner to send out flyers, to hand out flyers, to show that this disaster isn't over at all. And I just want to say, because you started by saying to do something in Portland, Oregon, is that several years ago, on a truly, truly frigid day in Chicago, when we could hardly hang on to the banner because the wind was so strong, there might have been 11 of us all together, and I took pictures and sent it to Rico and other friends in Fukushima, and it made them so happy. Mm. This was such a tiny gesture, but for them to feel that they haven't been forgotten in a place as far away as Chicago was truly meaningful. So this time with the Olympics, and I really want to quote great anti-nuclear hero, Professor Hiroaki Koide, formerly of Kyoto University, who's recently written about the Olympics and what that means, is that having pointed out that the declaration of nuclear emergency has never been rescinded, it was declared on March 11, 2011, has never been rescinded, and pointed out all the risks and all the costs being paid by the people of Fukushima and elsewhere and the environment, he ended his statement by saying that the countries and people who choose to participate in the Olympics will not only be risking exposure to themselves, but will be participating in the crimes of the Japanese nation, the crimes that the Japanese nation is perpetuating upon its own citizens, and really citizens and living things on the world. So I think that's about as stark as can be put. And so people at NICE came up with the idea of having a new event, shall we call it, Run for Your Life, of putting on hazmat suits and running in the vicinity of the Consul General with a mask, with the five rings.
Wonderful.
With the radiation symbol in the middle. And to then alert people to what it means to be prepared to question what the promotion of the Olympics means. And I should quickly say that it won't be hard for all of you to imagine that this money could be spent in very, very, very different ways.
Yes.
To keep on monitoring the health, to provide health care, to provide evacuation assistance, to keep on, to instead of covering up the health risks that are very and ever more present, to try to assist people who have to live with this unredeemable event,
right,
to live with this as best as humanly possible, instead of holding this extravaganza, which is meant to make everyone forget what happened.
Yes,
create more censorship. Yeah.
And Norma, I just want to add, in all fairness, I saw online that Northern California is going to be involved in some actions. Not in Portland, but in Northern California, they seem to understand the crisis. Mm-hmm. And also, too, this Rico's speech is going to be aired in a community-supported radio station in Hood River. And the man who's doing this, who's hosting this show, is part of Columbia River Keeper. So her speech will go out there, and it's also going to be aired in Seattle. I can't remember the name of that radio station, also community supported. So things are happening. You know, we're remembering here as best we can. That's for sure.
Yes.
So I have a question for both of you. What can your average person who is maybe just learning about this right now or has kind of felt powerless to do something, what are some easy action steps that your average American can take to try to bring awareness or even talk to our own government about taking steps to try to help the Japanese people?
Right. Well, you started out, first of all, by bringing us to Hanford. And I think one of the things is to look around you. Are you a beneficiary of nuclear power? Do you live within a weapons production site? Because these technologies are the same. They represent nuclear fission. And one of the first things I learned from Ruiko that as someone who's not ever been in favor of nuclear power, when she became an activist, she said, I decided I didn't want to be dependent on a power source that required that others always be exposed to radioactivity. So please keep that in mind, that we cannot have nuclear power without others being exposed.
Absolutely.
We ourselves too, actually.
Absolutely.
Exposed. So that's one thing, is to remember our own vulnerability and the vulnerability of those around us. Secondly, specifically, if you go online and just look at Mother's Radiation Lab, or if you can think of it, Mother's Radiation Lab Fukushima, it doesn't matter, it will take you to the English site of an extraordinary institution that exists near the reactor. And it's woman-started, woman-maintained, citizen activism at its best, of measuring soil, food, supporting, because there is so much pressure not to be anxious or express one's anxiety, a safe place for mothers worried about their children's health to get medical care, to support the continual monitoring of the environment and of bodies and food. Mother's Radiation Lab, it's a very ambitious place. It can always stand help. And just going to this site will give you so much more information in 2 minutes than you can otherwise get. So I would encourage everyone to try clicking to find Mother's Radiation Lab and find out more about what these extraordinary women and their supporters are doing.
It was so wonderful to hear about that project. I am just grateful for that, and I'm so glad we get to share the work of this lab. It's just really, truly amazing. I wanted to add about Hanford. You know, Hanford in this region has been very normalized as part of the history. And part of it, the famous B reactor, has been turned into a nuclear theme park of sorts. And, you know, it's very frightening. And lately the push has been towards introducing small modular reactors, SMRs, through the legislation, getting permits passed, and getting out these small mini nukes everywhere and anywhere. And that's one of the things we're struggling with. And this is billed as, you know, a green, clean form of energy as a way of dealing with climate change. So it's pretty insane. And that's one of the things that we're struggling with. And so for us here, in response to Jenna's question, what can you do? Understanding what's happening and letting, you know, our politicians know this is not what needs to be happening. This is not green, clean energy, and we don't want this for all the reasons, you know, that it's just so dangerous. And so that's part of what a nuclear activist, I think, does is, you know, it seems not a lot, but I think sharing, educating one another, and challenging, as Rico has so amazingly done, and you, Norma. I'm ever grateful. Thank you so much.
You know, we're running out of time here, so I just want to make sure that we get out all the pertinent information. We'll make sure to put all those links on this episode page on our website on kboo.fm, so you can visit our website so you can learn more about all the efforts that are being taken to try to bring light to this issue, which is a global issue. So I really want to thank Norma Field, who is talking to us from Chicago. Thank you for your actions that you're taking in Chicago today. And thank you, Laura Feldman, so much for joining me here in studio here in Portland.
And thank you, Yuki. Shout out to Yuki in Los Alamos.
If you're unaware of who Yuki is, here in Portland, she is an artist and she does great work. Especially, you'll always hear about her when she does work around Hiroshima Day. She always does great educating events to let us know how, well, you know, our past and the present are still very much tied today. And I'm going to give you guys both each maybe just 30 seconds as we got to wrap up here. If somebody wanted to do, you know, we're talking about actions, if you could do one thing today, your average person, if I could walk out of the studio, what could I do? What is that one simple thing I could do? Laura, what would you have me do?
I would remind them that today is the 8th anniversary of Fukushima, and I would talk to them, if I could, a little bit about what that actually means. That immediately springs to mind is, you know, word of mouth education, informing people. How about you, Norma?
Same thing. And I think, you know, I might just put it this way. 8 years ago today, the Northern Hemisphere was changed forever again.
Yeah. I remember I was at PSU at the time, and when I heard the news, I almost fell to my knees. I knew what it meant, and I was surrounded by people who didn't seem to care, so it was even more horrifying. So,
yes.
On that note, let's all remember that we do live in a global economy. We live in a place where even our actions within the climate and how we affect it are global. Thank you very much to Norma Field and Laura Feldman for joining me today and for bringing some light to 311. You've been listening to Radio Zine, a production of KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Music in this episode included Phase 4 by Silo Zico. You can find more of their music online at freemusicarchive.org. For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Jenny Okuyama. Thank you so much for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project has been working to protect and restore the ecosystems of the Blue Mountains in Eastern Oregon Cascades since 1991. This annual benefit party features DJs, speakers, cider, and more. Again, that's the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 North East Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Stand by for the Noontime Jamboree. Come on! Come on! Come on! Come on!
All you big and burly men who roll the trucks along, better listen, you'll song. You have really got it made if you're hauling goods any place on earth but those Haynesville woods. It's a stretch of road up north in Maine that's never, ever, ever seen a smile. If they buried all the truckers lost in them woods, there'd be a tombstone every mile. Count 'em off. There'd be a tombstone every mile. When you're loaded with potatoes and you're headed down, you gotta drive the woods to get to Boston town. When it's winter up in Maine, better check it over twice. That Haynesville road is just a ribbon of ice. It's a stretch of road up north in Maine that's never, ever, ever seen a smile. If they bear